I'm very privileged to be sitting across from a man named Mark McCormick. I'm sure you know him. You probably recognize him from television, from three national best-selling books. What they don't teach you at Harvard Business School, what they still don't teach you at Harvard Business School, and the 110% solution. I think a lot of people know Mark originally by a generalization that was made about him years ago, which is he's the man who helped Arnold Palmer make his millions. But I think the reality is he's much greater than some generalization can make of a part. He really created an industry. He started with a $500 investment and built a series of companies now known as the International Management Group, or IMG, that now produce $1 billion in business, employ 1,000 people in 20 countries. And the thing I'm most impressed about you, Mark, is just your capacity to take ideas and make them simple and practical and usable for anybody, whether in sales, negotiation, or management. And I want to, first of all, thank you for taking the time to visit with us. I know it was your wife's birthday yesterday and taking one of your days off. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's great to be here with you. And I've followed your career and admired it for a long time, and it's a pleasure to meet you.
Well, thank you so much. I thought we might start out. You've built, your level of success is unquestioned as a businessman internationally, not just nationally. But it might be interesting, since we hear so much about you, to find out what's part of the genesis. Where did you start out? I'm talking specifically going back to maybe even your childhood. What were you like as a kid? Who was Mark McCormick as a kid? What were some of your beliefs and values? And what really shaped you to give you the kind of drive and consistency and intelligence and balance that you seem to utilize on a daily basis?
Well, if I could answer that, I'd probably have a lot of answers that so far I've never been able to really get. But I started out in Chicago. I was an only child. I love sports from day one, especially football and baseball, all the sports that kids liked in those days. And when I was about 6 years old, I got hit by a car, and I was unable to play football, which was a very depressing thought to me. And my dad, sensing that I liked sports and wanted to compete, thought that he'd start me out in golf. And I suppose was because I had a fractured skull and I couldn't play tackle football. And in those days, not that many people were playing golf, and certainly not that many kids were playing. And so I started. And that got me started in golf, which led to an awful lot of what I've done. And and the rest of it, I suppose, as a young kid, I skipped the third grade. So I was always a year and a half younger. I was also born in November, which means that I started school when I was 5, and I started college when I was 16, which was younger than everybody else. And I was a little bit of a loner, perhaps, when I was young, and I was always inventing games, football games and basketball games and baseball games and things like that. And I suppose that inventiveness led to a lot of things that I've done later in life. And I was a great sports fan. I used to know all the batting averages and all the, like many kids, all the first down statistics and passing statistics and things like that. And I, but because of my interest in golf starting from age 6, I really followed that sport very, very, very closely. And because I think, like all kids, you want to be the number one at what you do. And I had myself pegged to become a golf champion.
Wow. And did that occur for you?
I got to be good enough to get into things. I won the Chicago Prep School Championship, and I played in the U.S. Open and in the U.S. Amateur about 4 times. But I very quickly figured out that I wasn't going to be good enough to win anything or to be in the same league as some of the greats were. And so at least I was smart enough to figure that out. And then I guess I'd gone to college and to law school, and when I got out of law school, I was trying to figure out some way to use my legal training and my interest in golf and make the two of them work together. And that's what started the genesis of IMG and the things that I've done.
Well, let's talk a little bit about IMG. What was really the trigger for you back then? I know you talked about seeing that people had a lot more leisure time and that sports were being brought to America through television on a massive scale. The drama was. But what really triggered you to start looking at that and believe that there was really a market for the services, or even create services that didn't exist previous to yourself?
Well, I was, as I say, I was a sports fan in general, but I really knew a lot about golf, and I'd played tournaments, and I knew some of the golfers, and I was a lawyer. And I thought to myself that most every country club in the country, no matter how exclusive they were, would like to have had a top player playing at their course for no other reason, so the members could say Sam Snead was here and drove it up by that tree on the third hole and things like that. Most of these clubs, of course, didn't want to have a tournament because that would tie the golf course up during the season and the members couldn't play and all that, and that was not anything they wanted to have. So I had the idea that I would try to solicit exhibition matches for some of the top golf players by mailing to country clubs and saying, how would you like to have an exhibition? And I knew the golfers, so nobody was doing this then. So I started making these mailings to the clubs, and we got a pretty good response. And this was giving me something to do in my spare time, and it was fun. It was keeping me within the sport. And then some of the golfers said, look, you're a lawyer. You know golf. Why don't you take a look at some of the contracts that we've got? And why don't you try to figure out some ways to get us product endorsements or things? So I thought, okay, nobody was doing that then either. So I looked at some of the contracts, and some of them were pretty absurd in those days. I remember Arnold Palmer was my first client, and he had a contract with Wilson Sporting Goods, which was a worldwide contract giving them exclusive rights to his name in the golf equipment category around the world for not too much money, which wasn't really the point. But the point was that I knew that in Australia, for example, which was a huge golf country, you were not allowed to sell golf clubs unless they were manufactured in Australia. And I knew Wilson didn't have any manufacturing facility in Australia. So I said, well, Arnold, why should you have a contract with Wilson for a territory like Australia where they can't sell?
They can't even market it.
And you should have a contract with Dunlop or Slazenger's down there. So that again led into the territorial concept of sports contracts, which we've gotten so famous for over the years. And so we went to Wilson and ultimately got them to release Australia and did other things. Anyway, that all kind of sort of flowed in golf. And then I got, as I think everyone in business that's been successful has done, I got very lucky because the first three clients that I had were Arnold Palmer, Gary Player, and Jack Nicklaus. And as obvious as that sounds today, Nicklaus was an amateur and had heard what I was doing with Arnold and came to me one day and said, could I help him? Player had never played in America except for once in his life, and he had a friend in the advertising business with whom he used to stay in Chicago who happened to know my dad, who told his friend what I was doing, and so I met Gary that way. And Arnold, of course, I had met and was doing some work for. So then these three fellows started winning absolutely everything in sight. Television hit about the same time, and I was the only game in town in terms of business opportunities for a golfer. So that began the company, which ultimately became IMG.
Now you went from there into tennis.
Tennis started with Laver in 1968. Jackie Stewart was a race driver, and Jackie signed with us in 69, I think. Jean-Claude Keeley, the skier, won the triple gold medals at Grenoble in 68. So at that point, we decided to be very selective. We resisted. We did a couple of smart things, a lot of dumb ones, but a couple of smart ones. One was, when Palmer, Player, and Nicklaus started winning everything in the early 60s, people from all kinds of sports came to us, or to me, to represent them and manage them. And I was smart enough to figure out I didn't have the staff to do it, and that I wanted to concentrate on the job at hand, and I turned a lot of them away for a lot of years. Ultimately, about 5 or 6 years later, I started to think about expanding the company into other sports and into other countries. And that's when we did sign, as I say, Laver in 68, Keeley in 68, Jackie Stewart shortly thereafter, and got ourselves into some of those other sports.
Now, today, IMG is, first of all, a couple of interesting things. I noticed in your book several times talking about that you focus on, just as you said, being selective, making sure you had a certain specialty, growing at a slow rate, although it sounds difficult to imagine that, starting with a $500 investment, going to $1 billion in business, but over 30 years, I guess that's possible. But I guess the question I have for you is, what was the fundamental focus that you had in terms of building your business back then that you think might be different than most entrepreneurs really start out with?
Well, I was in a personal service business, and I think so many entrepreneurs that are in a personal service business go into some rather false multiplication processes. We all know it's a restaurant we like, and it's a great Italian restaurant, and there's a guy there that runs it and takes care of it, and he's making $2,000 profit a week or whatever it is, and he quickly decides that if he could open 5 restaurants, he'd make $10,000 a week, and so he does that, but what he misses is that it's his personal touch on that restaurant that makes it, and the result of that is that none of them work well, and the whole group starts losing money, and that happens in so many businesses so often around the world. And I recognized that, first of all, you had to go really slow because of the personal services element of the business. And one of my mentors was and still is a fellow named Lou Wasserman, who's chairman of MCA, who tried to buy our company back in the 60s. And I told him I'd really like to try to do it on my own. And he's been very helpful to me ever since. And he said, you know, one thing you've got to do, he says, when we first started out, we were booking bands, and our first client was Guy Lombardo. When MCA became a multi-million dollar corporation on the New York Stock Exchange, Guy Lombardo was still calling Jules Stein, the founder of MCA, to ask what arrangement to play on the Roosevelt Roof in New Orleans on a particular night. And he said, you're going to have the same situation with the Arnold Palmers and, yes. and what have you. You're never going to be able to change that, so don't try to delegate that away. But in order to expand in a personal service business, what you've got to do is to hire people smarter than you are and to sublimate your ego and to sell the company, not yourself. Because the more you sell Mark McCormick this, Mark McCormick that, the more all new clients are going to only want to deal with Mark McCormick.
Yes.
But if you get people smarter than you are and believe in them, delegate to them, and then sell them and the company, that's the way to expand a personal service business. And that is exactly what happened. We've got a lot of very bright people working for us who know infinitely more about elements of our business than I do or ever would. And we've tried to sell the company as opposed to selling me. And that's how we expanded.
Well, you've really expanded tremendously. Now some of your clients are the Olympics, the Vatican, the Nobel Foundation. And that's incredible diversity. Now, how did those kinds of diversities occur for you?
Well, they've all, you know, the one thing I never believed that just because someone had always been a certain way or done in a certain way, that it necessarily had to always be done that way.
Yes.
And when we first went to Wimbledon and began representing Wimbledon, the finals always were on Saturday. And I don't think anybody had really thought about the Sunday situation in terms of the economics of it. And of course, the television rights situation on weekends are much better than they are on weekdays. So if you have two weekend days, sure. you're much better off than one. So in many instances, we've gone to people and we have done things which had never been thought of before, which look awfully obvious. Looking back at it, taking Wimbledon again, I went to the Wimbledon committee in the late 60s and suggested to them that they might do entertainment tents or corporate marquees, as they're now called. And they said, well, who would ever pay for those? And and I said, well, you let me have some of that space back there and I'll give you a guarantee and I'll run the tents for you and what have you. So we did that. And that's, of course, the most successful tent operation in the world today. And there's a line a mile long of people trying to get them. Same thing with Wimbledon merchandising. There's a very conservative group, the Wimbledon Committee, and it's a very uncommercial tournament. But people around the world were using the Wimbledon name, many of whom without authorization, some of whom had trademarked the name on products, on different things, and Wimbledon was getting no proceeds and they had no control over the quality of the products. And I said to Wimbledon, I said, look, what you should do is to, first of all, stop unauthorized uses of your name. People are trading off of you. Second, what you should do is try to develop a program with a good logo and to start merchandising it yourselves where you can control it and earn considerable monies. And they said, well, by all means do that, but be sure you don't spend more money for buying trademarks or fighting the pirates than you can make for us on the licensing. So we did that. And there have been a lot of those examples. Now, the diversity, which you alluded to, I was up in Stockholm. We had signed Bjorn Borg when he was 15 years old back in the very early 70s. I was up there on occasion meeting him, and I'd been aware and intrigued by the Nobel Awards for a lot of years. And the head of the Swedish Tennis Federation was a man named Peter Wallenberg, who was from the Wallenberg banking family there, who knew the Nobel Foundation. And the thing that intrigued me about the Nobel Awards was that every time someone gets an award, it's always on the front page of the paper, and you read the headline, so-and-so wins Nobel Award for Physics, and you start reading about a seven-paragraph article, and after about a paragraph and a half, you have no idea what they're talking about, and you say, isn't that nice, and go on. So what I did is I thought to myself that if there were a way to humanize those laureates and tell the average reader what they'd done that made sense,
yes.
that would be of interest. And so I went to the Nobel Foundation and I asked them about that, and I suggested that they had no television program of the Nobel Awards, and my idea was to do a television program, 40 minutes of which would be humanizing and introducing the laureates, and 20 minutes would be the pomp and circumstance of the ceremony. And they said, "Well, fine, that would be great. Do that." And they accused me of now of telling them that they should have, instead of announcing the awards like they do from October through November, and presenting them, which they always do on December 10th, they accused me of suggesting to them that they would have five nervous physicists in the audience waiting for the award, and Paul Newman up there with the envelope, please, and the winner is for splitting the molecules of whatever. And but at any rate, so we've developed a very good relationship with them, and that's led to a lot of other things. We've, during the 5 hours of or so, or 8 hours of interviews we have with a Nobel laureate to get down to 4 minutes of footage for our program, he tells a lot of things about what he's doing. And so we turn those into videos, which corporations make available to educational institutions. Because obviously, watching Einstein on video today is a lot more, would be a lot more interesting than reading the printed word. So we've developed a lot of other programs for the Nobel Foundation. Have a wonderful relationship with them. We also recently have begun representing certain of the publishing activities of the Mayo Clinic, and that happened because I was up there taking my physical every year, and I wondered, with that great name, what they did and how they worked commercially. And I talked to them about the Nobel Foundation, and I talked to them about Wimbledon and some of the other things we'd done, and that's led to a relationship with them in developing various products for them. But again, that's the kind of thing that most people wouldn't think about doing, well, or
which
suggesting.
Is, which is a very important question. You ask different questions than other people do. It's clear. You see the same things, but you ask a different question. Well, what's the primary set of questions you ask often? Because whether it's going to the Mayo Clinic, or you're going to Sweden, you're meeting Borg, there's a question or a series of them you must be asking.
Well, I suppose I ask why a lot. I don't know. A friend of mine, Tony O'Reilly, who runs Heinz and is one of the leading business people in the world and was a great rugby player, told me that I'm the best lateral thinker that he's ever known, that he usually, when someone starts a conversation with him, or he can always tell exactly where they're going with it, he says, but I always sort of am asking another kind of question, or going at it from an entirely different direction. And I suppose I do that. I react differently to a given set of facts than most people. Now, I can't describe that much more accurately than that, except to say, you know, when you're dealing with the Nobel Foundation, they're a very conservative group. I very often have said they make the Wimbledon Committee like a rock group, because they're really very, you know, but still there are things that they're doing. Now, this year, for example, we're working with them on a thing we've developed called the Nobel Jubilee, which is something that they never thought about quite doing the sorts of things that we're doing. They are inviting all of the living laureates back to Stockholm this December. We're going to do a Nobel concert with Kiri Tikanawa and Sir George Schulte as a part of this celebration. We've got David Frost coming in to do a Nobel debate, which is going to be all the laureates looking at the 21st century and what does the world have to do to become a better place in the 21st century with the great brains of the world. But those are things that we thought of and created, and that they thought was consistent with their objectives. And of course, there are some commercial elements of those, and all of them can be annualized if they work well. So yes, we're looking forward. We're recreating the first Nobel Prize dinner, that we're calling it a 1901 dinner, in the same place in the Grand Hotel in the Hall of Mirrors with the same menu, and doing a lot of things of that kind, which again, they've never thought about doing before, but there are a lot of very interesting commercial elements to that.
So it seems like you're always looking at how to maximize the impact somebody has and set up a system that can let that happen long term.
But more importantly, to do it consistently with the image that they have and with the traditions that they've established. I think everything that I've done at Wimbledon, you look at Wimbledon today, it still doesn't have anything on the center court except vines and green.
Yes.
It's got a Rolex scoreboard. That's the only thing that we did to alter that.
Yes.
But it's a very tastefully done scoreboard, and the Nobel Awards are exactly like they've always been done, and yet we're taking some of the elements they have, and consistent with their traditions, consistent with their goals, and we are showing them how to maximize these things from the standpoint of exposure and from the standpoint of economics.
Would it be fair to say, Mark, that a good deal of your success as a negotiator comes from that same focus of knowing who you're dealing with and showing them how to get what they want through their values rather than coming in with a set of your own?
I think that's right. I think that's probably a good point. Thinking about a thing that happened at Wimbledon this year, everyone knows what's happened in Eastern Europe. anyone that follows tennis knows that there are a lot of very good tennis players that come from Eastern Europe, from Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Russia, Hungary, and what have you. And for that reason, the television stations and networks in Eastern Europe are very interested in tennis, but they have no money to pay for the Wimbledon rights. Wimbledon is interested in exposure in Eastern Europe because they want to enhance their championship and get it exposed more. And so what I had to find was somebody that was interested in exposing their name in Eastern Europe and using the Wimbledon television as a way of getting into Eastern Europe. So we worked an arrangement out with DuPont, which was very interested in that particular marketplace. And DuPont funded the production of a series of highlights every day from Wimbledon, which we gave compliments of DuPont to the Eastern European television stations, who were thrilled to get it. So Wimbledon got their exposure. The viewers in Eastern Europe got the tennis, and the networks were happy. And DuPont got the credit for bringing this material into Eastern Europe. But again, that's taking a fact A and fact C and getting a fact B to connect them, which is what we've been able to do very often.
What is your passion? I mean, I know in your book, The 110% Solution, you talk about do what you love, and then you'll have that consistent drive. What really drives you? What is your real passion?
Well, I love creating things. I love sports. And I just cannot tell you how much I love everything that I do with my life. I mean, I get up in the morning and can't wait to make my phone calls or read the mail or to get into the day. And I've been very lucky with that. And I get a lot of vicarious thrills from when clients of ours win an event. I feel like I've won the event. And I'm a huge sports fan, and I root vigorously for clients and very much against all non-clients and all that.
So
and
do you have any clients that are in the World Series right now?
We've got a number of baseball players. We have represent about 70 or 80 baseball players and have a couple on the World Series teams. But, you know, same with football, same with golf, same with tennis and what have you. So it's... I suppose my passion is my work, and the reason I've gotten so much into time organization and time management is that we're doing so much and I'm doing so much. And yet I also enjoy other things. I enjoy resting. I enjoy playing tennis and playing golf. I enjoy travel. I enjoy eating at good restaurants. And I desperately want to make the time for me to do all that, and that's required me to become a real fanatic on time management, personal time management for myself and in organizational strategies for dealing with my life and our corporate life.
Well, let's talk about some of those. What are some of the most important tips you could share with someone? I think just reading your materials is really fine. You found a way to keep a balance in spite of the fact you're juggling all these companies and business. So what are some of the most important elements of really managing your time effectively so that you have a balanced life and you succeed at the level that you do?
Well, I think, first of all, I think the taking time to organize time rather than letting time control you for you to control time. In other words, I will spend a fair amount of time each day planning the next day or the next few days very meticulously. I've gotten very good at learning how long things take for me to do, how long certain phone calls are going to take, and what have you. And in this time planning, what I will do is to always allow leisure time for myself, maybe even a nap. I've done a lot more of that lately. I get up very early in the morning. I'm up usually when I'm working, which is most of the time, at 4:30, and very often my secretaries will arrive. I have a secretary in one in Cleveland, one in New York, and one in London who takes dictation, a different one in each place, and they'll usually come over to the house, say at or wherever I am in my apartment, or at say 5 in the morning or thereabouts, or a little before, and I'll do about an hour and a half of dictation, get that done, and then the next day they'll come back and bring the prior day's dictation. And then another secretary will come over and we'll do the one that would work on schedule and other things of that kind. I'm a nut about reading the papers first thing in the morning because I want to know what has happened, and I
do that. But you don't spend a lot of time doing that.
No.
Don't you have a rule about 10 minutes?
Well, it doesn't take me that much longer. It takes me, I read in New York, for example, I'll read USA Today, which I think is a fantastic newspaper, and the New York Times, late city edition. I get very bugged when I don't get the late city edition because it doesn't have the late sports if it doesn't. And then but it'll take me 15 minutes to read the two papers. But I go to certain parts of them, and I know I'm a very fast reader, but I know just what I want to look at. Then I kind of know what's happened. And then I get ready for my day sort of about 8 or 8:30 after I've done all that, and usually have meetings, and they go through lunch. And I pretty much have business lunches I enjoy, as I've written many times. I get, first of all, I like eating at good restaurants, and secondly, I learn more about people and get more accomplished in that atmosphere than in a business meeting usually. And then what I'll try to do often is, or most always, is to get a couple of hours, an hour and a half or so nap in the afternoon. And so I usually won't have any meetings between 2:30 and say 5:30 or 6. If I'm in Europe, what I'll do is I'll take an hour and a half nap, and I'll use the other hour and a half or so to make calls to America. And here I'll do pretty much the same thing, I'll making phone calls, and then I'll maybe have a couple of meetings early evening, and then always have, very rarely have any business dinners. I'll usually do that strictly socially.
Now, is this 5 days a week, 6 days a week, 7 days a week for you, what you just described?
Yeah, it's 5 days a week. I mean, it's, you know, there are times when I'm at Wimbledon or in other very busy times for me, or at the Olympics and things like that, where your weekends are just the same as every other day. But normally, I won't do that kind of stuff over the weekend.
So let's talk about some of the organizing principles behind what you've said. So I remember reading, I think, in one of your books where you said you'll spend an hour each day to plan the other 23 hours.
Yeah.
Is that true?
That would be for sure true. The hour might not be a steady hour. It might be 20 minutes in the morning to figure out what I'm going to do during the next 5 or 6 hours, and then I might do another 20 minutes late in the morning to see how things have gone and how I'm going to readjust it or things like that. And I'm also way ahead. I mean, I could literally, not that this is any big deal necessarily, but it makes my life easier for me. I could tell you between now and Christmas, and this being October 24th, I could tell you not only what I'm going to do every day and where I'm going to be, but pretty much what time it's all going to happen.
Wow. Is that something you picked up from one of your clients? I remember reading about one of your clients who impressed you and knew even what flight they were going to be on.
Well, Lendl did. That was Yvonne Lendl. He once told me, we were talking about when we were going to get together and have a golf game in Florida, and this was back in November or something, and he said, well, next March, let's do it right before the Lipton. I'm going down on March 13th, and I'm going to be on such and such a flight and whatever, which is impressive. But no, I do it because I try to... You know, we have now about 1,500 full-time employees in the world, and there's an awful lot of internal management that is important for me to do, because the key to our company working as geographically spread as it is communication between amongst each other. And you don't want to over-communicate, which can be a problem, but you at the same time don't want to under-communicate, and trying to have the right mix of meetings and with the right mix of people takes a lot of scheduling. So, I mean, we have meetings scheduled for next February, next March, next April now, fairly meticulously done in terms of who's coming and where and all that kind of stuff.
I remember also reading you talked about, from a management standpoint, that you would spend, I've forgotten the number, an hour to save 5 minutes. What did you mean by that?
Well, what I'm saying is so often people miss that absolutely critical point, which is that, you know, it takes too long to explain to Joe or to Susan how to do this. I can do it myself much easier. I can get something done in 5 minutes that would take me an hour to explain to them. But what people fail to recognize when they do that is that if they would take that hour, that would save 1,000 5-minute pieces in the next 4 or 5 years, and it would also enable you to devote more of your time to things which are more productive for you. I think so often we get into habits. Certainly we get into them in our personal lives, whether, you know, when we brush our teeth and how we do it in the morning and where the toothpaste is and what have you. And we do it in our business lives too. And sometimes you got to keep reevaluating those habits to make sure that they are still as productive, if they're business habits, both personally and professionally, as they were when they were created. There are an awful lot of people who just have always done something a certain way and continue to do it. And maybe it made sense when they started, but not later. We had one of our top television executives that runs our U.S. television operations, a fellow named Barry Frank, who's sold the television rights to many of the recent Olympic Games and on behalf of the organizing committees, and he's a brilliant guy. And he created, along with a guy named Dick Button, the figure skating supremo, an idea many years ago called the Superstars, which was a television program that's run now for 17 or 18 years on the air, maybe even longer. And Barry, because it was his baby, so to speak, when it was first done, he went down and wanted to make sure the production was correctly done, and he was lining the bicycles up on the track and making sure the bicycle race was going well and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, about 9 years later, he's still down there lining up the bicycles, and I said to him, it's been a kind of a joke between him and me about, I say this is like lining bicycles up at the Superstars, you know, because you like it, you like lining up the bicycles, but then you have to ask yourself, is it really, do I have to do it anymore? Because other people can do it now, and I could be out trying to do something far more productive for my company that I might enjoy just as well. But we all get into habits like that, and we all, I think, have to keep reevaluating them.
And moving up the focus of where you're putting your time and your energy so it's most productive. Let me ask you, what do you think are the core beliefs that have separated you from other people? I want to go back to that a little bit. What is, you know, one of those beliefs obviously is that the way things have been done doesn't mean it's the best way, that's for sure.
Right.
But what are some of the other beliefs that you have that have kind of been guiding principles for you in your success?
I'm a very strong believer that you've got to be very precise and meticulous in doing exactly what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. If it's a money thing, for the cost that you've said you're going to do it for. And I take a lot of pride in being very punctual and very precise. And I like to actually knock people out with my organization, my personal organizational techniques. My theory there is that if they see me doing this and see me doing it and continuing to do it, that they will ultimately have so much confidence in me and our company, if they see others in my company doing it the same way, that that will be the thing, the hook on which to hang a long and very successful relationship. So I am a nut on detail and attention to detail and follow-up and follow-through and punctuality, because I think it just is such an asset for you to have in life, not only business life, but your personal life. I mean, I just think that the person that says, you know, if I call somebody today and wish them happy birthday and I haven't seen them for 12 months and they're across the Atlantic Ocean or something like that, that just tells them so much about me that I feel good about them thinking about me, and it has so many ramifications personally and business-wise to me that I try very hard to do that sort of thing. So that's certainly one thing that I do, and I'm not sure if that's been responsive to your question.
Let me ask you this question, though. I know that while you talk about that level of precision, I know in your books you say, you know, do I take all my own advice? And you say, most of the time. And you could sound to some people as being so rigorous that you had no flexibility, and I know that's something you value. So how do you create that flexibility still there also?
Because of the unpredictable nature of some of the things that I've suggested to the Nobel Awards, the Wimbledons, and the Vatican. Those are all unpredictable and flexible, and I try to be unpredictable and flexible with my own life just as I have done for others. But I think you have to do it within an overview of rigorous organization. It's kind of hard to describe because it seems like an anomaly a little bit, but I don't really think it is. I think that I...
Keeping your commitments is the must, it sounds like, and then having the flexibility to change your approach is a major part of your focus.
Absolutely. And looking at things and saying, let's try a whole other approach is totally the opposite of, okay, to organize this event, we have to do this on March 1st and this on March 8th and this at 9 o'clock in the morning on March 11th. That's the rigorous approach. Well, but should the whole approach be varied? You know, and I think that's the flexibility.
So maybe it's the global thinking. You think globally at a flexible level, and when you once you put something into action, you're
then you've got to be very precise and meticulous.
That makes total sense. Sense. You also are a very practical man. I mean, I know that you, some people might say it sounds like you're a perfectionist, but the truth is, I remember reading you said, if you can spend 5 hours to get something to be 2% better, it's not worth it. Move on. Do something else. Know when to walk away from something, too.
I think that is right, and I think so often people want to find in the administrative areas of life or in our company or in any company, they want to find a system which applies to any contingency that comes up. People have often asked me what I think of Rupert Murdoch, and I've always said that he's someone that I've had a lot of respect for, and as a friend and as a businessman, and he's the kind of a person that a couple times that I've dealt with him, I remember one example, we represented a British television personality who's oh, sort of a little bit like a Johnny Carson, maybe a fellow named Michael Parkinson. And he was a big deal in Britain, and Murdoch at the time owned Channel 10 in Australia, and he wanted Parkinson to come down and do a series of shows in Australia. And so he and I, Murdoch and I, negotiated a contract for Parkinson to do that, and we hit the headlines of the contract, obviously. It was going to be so much a show, and then we said, and of course he's going to get his, he'll get expenses. So then it got turned over to the lawyers, as all these things always do, and they got into these huge fights about what the word expenses meant. And did that mean they got an apartment in Melbourne with a driver and a maid and a cook? Did it mean they got a single room at the Holiday Inn? Did it mean they got first class air? Did it mean they got portable phones or not? And, you know, if you wanted to spend hours and hours and hours and hours on trying to figure out what expenses made, you'd be being very unproductive. And you know, and Rupert and I had never talked about it, but I, you know, when I went back to him after the fact, at this point Parkinson was already in Australia, and he was more than fair in reasonably resolving this stuff. But so often you have people that want a system that answers all the questions, and to spend the extra 5 hours getting that from 98% right to 100% right just isn't worth it. Just leave it at 98.
Tell me about money. You deal with it every single day. You negotiate it. You have an interesting reputation in terms of your capacity to get the highest numbers there. And we live in a society yet you don't come across as being driven by money. That's one of the things I respect about you, although I know that you value it. What does money mean to you? Where is it?
Money means a lot to people that don't have it. And yes. I think the more you get of it, the less important it becomes. I wrote in one book that money is a or profits in a company, or what you use to keep score, if you use it in a sports context. I mean, you know, have you made the Forbes 400, or is your company's earnings better this year than last year, or how much do you make a year kind of thing are things that many people do use to keep score. So I don't think you should be ashamed of money. You're talking about it. At the same time, it's nothing that should make one all-consuming. I think everybody needs a certain amount of money. Once they've gotten that, then other things become more important. But I'm amazed often of how short-sighted people are about it, in the sense that I had an employee once who would obviously be trying to take the edge on his expenses all the time. And this is a fairly high-paid executive, a very high-paid executive, and it seemed so short-sighted for him to do that, because some of the stuff he was doing was so transparent to any reasonable person. And if the reasonable person happened to be his employer, what he's doing is, I mean, for him to get an extra $1,000 on his expenses during a 3 or 4 month period could cost him thousands and thousands of dollars in compensation. And it's just amazing the way people don't see that. But that's because they are so, I guess the old expression was penny wise and pound foolish or something, where they, you know, are trying to take that last little nickel out of a situation. And I think nothing is worse than that, actually, and that cuts across all kinds of business situations.
Well, even as a negotiator, I know have walked away from deals, or you talk about not getting every penny necessarily, even though you're known to get the largest amounts of money in your business. What is the psychology there?
I think flexibility is so important. I've very often talked, I remember negotiating once years ago with the Allstate Insurance Company. They had a major contract with Arnold Palmer. And the chairman was a wonderful man, a wise man named Judson Branch. And he's the guy I was negotiating with. And he really saw the big picture. And he had a lot of people, though. Again, the lawyers were trying to pin it down. And sort of the concept was Arnold would get a certain amount of money. Allstate would get use of his name in advertising and a certain amount of his time. Well, when it got into the time, it was a question of, well, how many days? And then it was, oh, well, maybe 4 days. And what's a day? Is a day when you fly in one night and do a dinner and leave, or is it 24 hours, or if he comes in the morning and leave, and all that kind of stuff. And I said to Judson Branch, I said, look, I know Arnold Palmer pretty well, and he's not the kind of person, when he gets involved with something, that will do it lightly. And if you start defining the 4 days and start defining the hours, you're going to create the exact wrong chemistry for this relationship to work. What you should do with Arnold Palmer is to say, look, we're going to pay you this money. We're going to get the right to use your name in advertising, subject to you approving it. And we want you to spend a reasonable amount of time doing promotional work for Allstate throughout the year.
Yes.
And that's the way that contract got done, and it worked brilliantly for years. And had it gone the other way, what, you know, Arnold would have been so irritated at the fact that somebody was actually
trying to control
that he had to be there 4 hours or it didn't count as a day.
Or question his character or his integrity, certainly.
Right, and he's a guy that would spend the entire year saying good things about Allstate or going out of his way to do things if he didn't feel he had a gun on his head to do it.
Yes, interesting. Give me your definition of success.
Well, I think success is accomplishing something which makes a significant contribution to yourself, to the company you work for, or to society as a whole. And I think to the greater the results are compared to what the expectation was would determine the nature of the success.
Interesting. A great deal of your success is tied to your ability to create relationships and to nurture relationships. If there's somebody you want to create a relationship with, how do you do that? And then once you have it, what are some of the major focuses you have on how to nurture a relationship?
Well, I think that's like saying, what's a house cost? But I think very often some of the best business relationships I've gotten have been when I've never even mentioned business. Very often people will expect me to want to do a business deal. If it's a sports personality, they'll expect me to want to sign them. If it's an entertainment personality or somebody that we're trying to represent or a musical personality. You know, we've had a wonderful business relationship with Kiri Takanawa, the opera singer. And I spent years with her just admiring her as a person. She liked sports and didn't get a lot of chance to see them. And she'd come out to Wimbledon or the British Open, or I would see her and her husband socially and never really talk about business, except to learn a little bit about the classical music business, which subsequently has become a major part of IMG. And I think there have been golfers or tennis players that I will have spent time with and never said, sign with our company, or why aren't you with us, or we can do this and that for you. And I think it so disarms people when I spend time with them and never even bring up these issues that pretty soon it's almost flip-flops and they're trying to get with us. It's interesting, but that is just one thing that has worked for me because of the nature of what I am perceived to be by so many people, which is someone that wants to get a business deal done and all that. And I, similarly, with many of the best corporate relationships we have flowed from things that started out as personal relationships where we've really just spent time together because we enjoy each other, not that I'm trying to sell them proposals and what have you. And some of my best friendships have come in that way as well. So I think, again, it's a little bit an unpredictable course of conduct that I might show towards people, which has a lot of very positive and effective end results.
How do you nurture relationships?
Well, that was what I meant when I said about the house. I mean, it depends upon the relationship. I mean, I think there are different people who want different things out of a relationship. Many people think that if you don't call them every morning at 10 o'clock that you're not interested in them. Others only look to the results, if it's a business relationship, only look to the results of the business relationship and don't care if they ever see you. I've seen more business relationships last where Mr. A, client A, likes Mr. B, who's really incompetent, than I have where client A dislikes Mr. B, who is very competent. In other words,
is doing the job for
people
him.
Let the personal, if I don't like you, more often than not, even if you're brilliant, our relationship business-wise won't work. If I like you, even if you're stupid, it might work a lot longer. And that's the way life works.
Well, let me ask you this. Why do people like you, Mark?
I'm not saying people like me. I think a lot of people do, and I think people are continuously surprised at what they find when they get to know me, because I don't think I'm an ostentatious person. I've often said to employees that work for me, you know, I'm not someone that wants jet airplanes and yachts in the Mediterranean, and I don't lead an ostentatious life. I don't collect Rembrandt paintings or Van Goghs or things like that. All I want to do with the money that this company makes is to have money for it to expand and to share it with the people that have helped make it. And that's why the retention that we've had with employees has been very good, because I think everybody feels that I'm treating them very fairly, and everybody feels that I'm not bleeding the company for my own uses. And I also we have never, ever hired a corporate public relations firm a corporate publicity firm, nor have I ever personally hired a public relations or publicity person. I've never sought names in the paper kind of stuff. You could say, well, yeah, but it comes to you because of the stuff you're doing, and if it didn't come to you, maybe you'd be doing all that. But I don't really believe that. I don't go to a lot of social functions. I'm not someone that goes to parties and likes to flaunt anything I've got. And I like to think that I am more self-effacing than arrogant. And I think people sometimes tend to expect me to be arrogant and ostentatious, and they find me to be more humble and self-effacing. And I think that's why the people that like me like me.
This session continues on the next CD.
You mentioned about your employees. I noticed in one of your newsletters, you have a fabulous newsletter, by the way. I really love
that. Thank you. That's funny because I also think it's fabulous. And when we started it, I couldn't figure out how we were going to sustain it for more than a couple of years. And yet we have, and it's gotten terrific. And I just really enjoy doing it with Mark Ryder, who edits it, writes it, really. And what we do is we do this kind of thing, usually on the phone, where he's asking me questions that he's thought about, and we try to come up with things that are interesting. And I enjoy doing it, and I'm very proud of it.
It's called Success Secrets.
Right.
In this month's package of Power Talk, we're going to put in there some information so people can order it, because I highly recommend it. I think it's fabulous. But what I started to think of is one of the newsletters I read, you talked about the fact that you are absolutely for young people, new people, people that produce, being rewarded economically on a very large scale. And you said you're against commissions. And I thought your psychology was rather interesting. Maybe you could share that and tell me what you think the alternative is.
Well, I think that, first of all, since I was lucky enough at a young age to be representing Palmer, Player, and Nicholas, and to make, in those days, it was an awful lot of money very young, I have no hang-ups about people making money young. I also have no hang-ups about young people getting into positions of a lot of responsibility within our company. There have been a lot of examples where that has happened and happened very well. I'm totally against commissions, really, because in our kind of business, I'm not suggesting that there aren't businesses where this argument could be refuted, but in our kind of business, I'm really trying to get a real team effort applied to everything that our company does. And that means that I don't want people trying to be arguing about who's going to get the commission for this sale or that sale. If somebody thinks they can sell Chevrolet something, I would rather have them talk to all of the other people that might help them make that sale in our company rather than trying to hold that close to their chests and go zooming into Chevrolet to try to make a sale. We have a lot of them and us problems, like all companies do, with division to division, territory to territory,
yes.
And I'm constantly trying to break down those problems or those barricades to make everybody think, hey, it doesn't make any difference, guys, whether this is counts as Australian income or whether it counts as U.S. income. The question is, it's IMG's income, and I'm smart enough to know that the Australians helped do it. So
yes.
Let's not worry about where it gets in the balance sheet. Let's just do it, you know, and that's what I spend my life trying to get accomplished.
You also, though, made the point about if you're paying someone commission, for example, on a gross, the challenges with that, and if you're paying them on the net, the challenges with that. Maybe you could share that as well.
Well, yeah, if I hire someone to do something and do it on gross sales, he could spend $100,000 on advertising somewhere, and so he could make more gross sales, but wouldn't have made up the $100,000 in advertising and what have you. So I'd rather have people more conscious to the bottom line of what it is they're doing, which results in profit to the company. So I'm more interested in the net profits than I am in the gross sales.
But at the same time, as you don't want to work on a $10 million sale where you guys make 5% versus a $1 million sale where you can make 30% or something like that, simultaneously you said you don't want to pay people on net sales. Maybe you can share why you perceive that as well in terms of commission.
Again, we've had people in our foreign offices, for example, we give people bonuses, and their compensation obviously relates to how the company does on the whole and how their kind of area of the company does. And very often, if someone runs a geographical office, how does his region do? So if you get too specific about that, the guy is so interested in the net monies that his region makes this year, because that's going to affect his income this year, that he doesn't look at the long-term picture. And many of the things that we do is create events and manage events. And usually the events we create don't make all that much money in the first year. Sometimes they lose. The next year they'll break even. The next year they'll start making money. Then they become a great annuity. And what we've got to do is to stop people from being discouraged from taking a $200,000 loss. We did an equestrian event in Paris just last month, which probably lost us $100,000 to $200,000. But aesthetically, it was a huge success, and it will become, over the years, a big moneymaker for us.
Right.
And had the guy in our Paris office that was pulling the trigger on doing that event been negatively affected by that loss in the first year in his compensation, he may not have pulled the trigger. And so we got to do everything we can to discourage him from that kind of a mindset.
So how do you do that? One of those, you don't pay him on the net, but how do you decide compensation?
Well, the way I do it is subjectively. I'm talking now at the senior level, because obviously you have staff and administrative people who are judged as they are in any other organization. But at the senior level, what we do is make a subjective determination on how the person has done. I mean, I've often said when Bjorn Borg was winning 5 Wimbledons, a bellboy could have managed Bjorn Borg and earned hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of commissions for us, because all you have to do is a guy offers you $10,000, you say, I want 15, and settle for 11 or 12, and there you are. Anyone can do that. And so the guy that was managing Borg certainly had a lot of legs up in terms of the gross commissions he's earning than somebody who's maybe representing a young player who hadn't quite made it or something like that. And I think you have to ask yourself, how easy or hard was this particular task to do? How well was it done? Not necessarily how much money did it generate for us. So all these factors come into consideration. How well did the person communicate? How well did he delegate? How well did he hire people smarter than he is, rather than, as so many people do, are afraid of that? They want to hire people dumber than they are so that they won't have their job threatened. And so you evaluate all these factors and roll it all up and try to come up with a compensation package.
Interesting. You said earlier that one of the ways that you really learn how to interact with people is go to lunch with them. I know you also talk about going and playing golf with them.
Yeah.
And one of the major factors in your success is understanding people. I've heard you many times talk about business is nothing but relationships.
Right.
So what are some of the things you learn at lunch? What are some of the things you learn when you're on the golf course?
Well, I remember this, there's so much of that. I mean, I remember a story once of, just a dumb example, but I once took a guy to lunch and he said to me, I'll go to lunch with you, but I'm on a diet, I'm not going to eat. And I said, okay, well, fine, I'm going to eat. So we go to a restaurant and the waiter brings over the menus and this guy says, I'm just going to have a cup of coffee. So waiter said, fine. And then the waiter starts describing the special of the day and the pasta of the day to me. And he goes away while I'm thinking about it. And as he leaves, he says to the other guy, says, can I just bring you a little salad maybe? And the guy says, well, all right, maybe I'll have a little salad. Then he comes back for my order, and more time has elapsed now. And I said, tell me about the pasta one more time. And I said, that sounds great, I'm going to have that. And as the waiter's leaving, the man says, I'll just have what he's having. So about 5 months later, we were presenting a sales pitch, one of our other executives, to that company, and the decision maker was this guy. And the word came back that he said, no, he didn't want it. And it really made sense to me that this project for that company made some sense. And normally, when it came back, they said they didn't want it, we'd stick it in the file, and so-and-so turned it down and go on elsewhere. But I thought about the lunch, and I thought, when this guy says no, it doesn't necessarily mean no, and maybe if you present it a slightly different way, you can get him to say yes. In that instance, that worked. But that was an observation about somebody at lunch. But you can watch them do things. You can watch the guy move his ball in the rough on a golf course, or so often you have people putt up to within 2 feet of the hole, and you'll say, that's good. and they'll take the ball away. There are some people you say that's good, and they will, because they want to see how they're doing themselves, they're going to go putt it anyway. There are other people that'll have a ball 3.5 feet from the hole and will kind of take it away as if you're going to give it to them one way or the other, and yet there are others that'll be 3.5 feet from the hole, and they'll kind of go and half hit at it, and if it goes in, they'll act like they made it, and if it didn't go in, they'll act like, well, if they'd have tried, they would have made it, and take the score as if they'd made it. So there are all kinds of different things in golf that you can learn. But I just think when you take people out of their own environment, and their own environment is their own office or their own home, where they're in total control, and when you watch the way they deal with a waiter or a head waiter or a doorman or tip a hat check girl or order food, or if they drink wine, how they react to it or order it. There are just so many things. Pat Ryan, who was a managing editor of Life magazine up until a few years ago, always told me that because she was a woman, she would always, when she went out for lunch, order a scotch on the rocks because she thought that gave her kind of a power position which negated the fact she was a woman, that she was sort of doing that. And she also, you know, you talk about people when they're at a dinner table and they push all the dishes away as if that's sort of, again, an indication of they're now going to make a statement and an important point. But there are so many little things that you observe like that that I think are very interesting. I learn so much more from people that way, and it helps
that's
you.
That's what meetings probably never boring for you. You're always picking up something.
Well, I think you are, and I think... you know, you go into a meeting and you've sold something, and the minute I've sold something and somebody said yes, I want to get off the subject immediately and move on to other things and talk about the weather or something like that, rather than trying to say, well, now you really said you're going to do this, or right. Now this means that you're going to have to pay $4,000 next week and $28,000 the following week and all that. I just say, okay, now it's done, and then worry about it later with a little confirming letter or something like that. It's just a lot of little techniques like that, I think, are interesting.
So what have you learned about me from our interaction so far?
Well, that you're a very together person and totally in control of absolutely everything that's going on at all times. Well, everything about you is control. I mean, I think your tie is dead straight, your collar is perfect, your hair is right in place, you're very well dressed, and you know exactly what you're going to say and exactly when you're going to say it, and haven't flinched once on anything and what have you. So I'm sure that your success is very easy to figure out.
That's very interesting. Well, I think that's a compliment. I'll take it as such. Tell me, in influence, which is really what you do, what is the most important element of influencing another person?
I think making them believe in you and in your integrity. And I think very often that belief is in a different area from the area in which you're trying to influence them. I mean, if I'm trying to tell you to buy a stock, let's say, I'm not in that business, nor have I ever been, but I'm trying to say to you, I want you to buy Procter & Gamble because that will be a good investment. And it's important for me to do that. I think you're having confidence in my ability and my knowledge of these areas from other sources, usually other sources than from me, but certainly I want to be circling all around the Procter & Gamble issue. I don't want to be trying to push you to do that. I want you to feel so confident in anything I would say to you about maybe I ought to get off a stock and tell you that the best golf course real estate operation in the world that you could become involved in now would be in Orlando, and maybe what I would do is to demonstrate to you all of the mistakes I've made in real estate operations in the past and how I lost, because I think there's nothing worse than someone that tries to rattle off 82 successes and you think, where are the failures? And I tell you about my failures. I tell you about the experience I've had. I tell you, gee, we had this happen to us there and this happened to us there. And you're listening to all this. And then ultimately, so now I've got this huge credibility in this area of golf course investments, and that credibility is there. Now you are almost hoping I'm going to say to you, what could you invest in that would make sense
right.
at that point?
This is true.
And that's the further great. Away I get from trying to sell you the Orlando property, the better, kind of. So I suppose making people believe in you and in your integrity, and very often in collateral areas to where you're dealing, is, I think, the most significant way to influence someone.
What is the most significant element in management, if there's an organizing principle of being an effective manager? Because you're the best, you know, one of the best people need to these areas, so.
Well, I think in management, I think management by example is awfully important. I mean, it's very hard for me to take an extreme. If I had a yacht, which I don't, and I was in the south of France, and it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and I just kind of gotten up after a long night, and I was on my deck,
right.
Surrounded by a bevy of beauties or whatever. No, I'm sitting there, and I call Cleveland, Ohio, and it's now 5 in the morning there, say, and I say to somebody working for me, why aren't you up working? You haven't gone. And that's the extreme of the worst way to manage, you know. The best way is to, very often, when I'm in New York or Cleveland or in Orlando, I'll make all of my European calls, and I actually don't do it for this reason, but it's a heck of a fringe benefit for the reason of doing it. I will make all of my European calls from 4:30 till 6 in the morning, which is between 9:30 and 11 in the morning, and everybody knows where you are.
Yes.
And sometimes I've even called people at 9:30 in the morning, they aren't in yet, and I'll leave a message. And these aren't people working for me. They're companies I'm doing business with. I'll say, well, tell him when he comes in. I call him in New York and have him call me when he gets in.
So he realizes you called him.
So he knows I've called at 4:30, and you know, 10 minutes later he calls us. God, you know, and when I'm calling the client at 5 in the morning, my time, they know they're important to me, and they know I'm up there thinking, and they think, God, he's up at 5 in the morning. So management by example. In other words, if I am working 16 hours a day, it's makes people, even if I don't ask them to, sort of do the same kind of thing. Or if I'm up really early in the morning and there's no problem me getting someone at a 7 o'clock breakfast meeting, because they'll know I've probably already been up a couple hours before the breakfast meeting. So I think management by example is very important. And I realize there'll be a time I can't do that anymore, because ultimately I'm going to want to, well, I'm not sure, but presumably I'll want to work less, or hopefully when I become, when my lucidity leaves me, or my,
are you planning
that I will recognize that, as opposed to being an idiot kind of wandering around saying, well, we're going to do that.
That's what we're going to do today. Tell me the same answer in the area of negotiation. What's the single most important organizing principle or distinction that you utilize to be effective in negotiations?
Well, again, that's the house again. I mean, there's so many different kinds of negotiations. I think that knowing how far you're going to go or won't go in the crunch points of the negotiation before it starts is pretty helpful. I think a lot of people go into something, I want $100,000 for my house, which I'm going to sell you, and they haven't really decided that they would accept 92, and they're in the middle of it, and they emotionally react, as opposed to really getting the perimeters set. What are the hard points and whatever? The other thing I will always do is to try to deal with the all of the easy points first and save the hard point for last. That, first of all, sets a positive tone towards a constructive solution in the negotiation, and you resolve 14 easy points. You're together in agreement, and now you get to the sticky point. Somehow the atmosphere is better for dealing with the sticky point. And also, you know that if you conclude the sticky point, everything else is done.
Right.
So that's another thing that I'll do. I suppose that I use the phrase the dollar anchor. When nobody knows the price, because our business is such that you never know what the price is. What's the Nobel going to charge for giving curriculum materials to universities for some corporate sponsorship, and everyone's kind of wondering about that. And to use other examples of, IBM spent $500,000 doing this last year, this kind of program, and Amoco spent $1.2 million on their California educational program, and what have you. You're watching the other guy react to those numbers. And he could, I suppose, react and say, well, we could never spend anything even resembling that. Or, you know, and very often there are cases where the other person's going to name a higher number than you. There have been a lot of cases where I've sensed that and it's worked out where I would have taken X for something. And I've sort of said to the other party, look, I've thrown a few numbers of other comparable situations. And then I've said, well, you tell me what you think would be reasonable and I'll try to see if I can't work. And very often the number they'll come back with, having heard all these other examples, is a higher number than I would have asked for.
What about when you come to that impasse where numbers are things keeping you apart? You've got one number, they've got another. What's your strategy at that time?
What you try to do is to come up with some other things that don't involve numbers but are perceived to have a value. I mean, for example, if... again, maybe I'm being unfair using this example, but if I'm negotiating on behalf of... Wimbledon for television rights in America with NBC, and I want $10 million, and they want to pay $9 million, and we've been batting that back and forth for a long time. I might say to them, give me 20 television commercials, 30-second spots, to promote Wimbledon or Wimbledon products, which is something we actually did with NBC. Those spots don't cost them that amount of money, but have a value in the marketplace of that amount of money. And those spots very often might be unsold because they rarely would sell out all the time on all the telecasts. Or you might say to them, we will throw in a entertainment tent, which NBC knows if they buy is $100,000, but it doesn't cost Wimbledon $100,000. So Wimbledon is giving them something that really costs them maybe $30,000 that NBC can attribute $100,000. So you try to throw a lot of other things in there, because very often the guy you're dealing with wants to do the deal but has got somebody up above him that is saying you can't go a nickel more than this, and you're trying to give him some ammunition to go back and tell his superior, hey, we got to pay $10 million, but in addition to the television rights, we're going to get a tent and we're going to get
there's more added value perceived, or take the pain or the sting out of it by showing how they can do it where it's costing them less initially. Interesting.
Yeah.
In sports, you're dealing with the peak performers literally in the world, mm-hmm. or some of your best friends and clients. And I'm always fascinated by the differences in athletes or in anyone. You know, you see two people and one person has more innate talent or more skill or more education or more background, yet that does not guarantee that they're going to do better. You know, one of the phrases that I use a lot is that experience is no guarantee of success mm-hmm. in anything.
Yeah.
What do you think makes the difference in performance for anyone? I mean, you've got two people here, and they've got potentially equal ability. What do you think the major difference is, or at least what's one of the major factors in your mind?
There are three. And the first is everyone that starts out in sports or in business or in anything else wants to be number one at what they do. If they're a football player, they want to lead the team to the Super Bowl. A golfer wants to win the U.S. Open or whatever. If you're a lawyer, you want to be F. Lee Bailey or Clarence Darrow. And if you're a doctor, you want to be Christian Barnard or Jonas Salk or somebody. The champion never loses sight of that goal. And the guy that doesn't quite make it along the way gets diverted from that goal. Either life gets too easy, or he's earning a good living, or he somehow practicing that hard isn't as important because he's happy to be number 10. Or whatever. So that's one difference.
So he lowers the standard.
Standards get lowered as success comes. Because if you're hungry and you're out there just having been thrown out of your house on Christmas Eve, you know, you're going to, by God, I'm going to do it, you know. And then all of a sudden, it becomes, some of the stuff becomes less important maybe when you earn more money. Second, the champion at golf, business, sports, whatever, knows how to peak himself or herself at the most important moments. Obviously, everyone isn't 100%, or use my book title, 110% at all the time. There are going to be times when they're not going to be at their best. The champion will be at her best or his best when it counts the most, and they'll save secondary performances for secondary occasions.
Reggie Jackson, Mr. October, in other words.
That sort of thing, yeah, right. Or Montana in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, exactly.
You can just see the way these people perform. You know, a leading tennis player or any sport you want to think of. And lastly, that no matter how good you get at something, the champion never has any degree of complacency. He never pats himself or herself on the back and says, I'm the best, isn't it fantastic, I'm great. He always is striving for more. And I think the same is true in business as well. If you just won a great victory in the law courts, or you've just become president of your corporation or led it to the highest earnings in its history, or your restaurant's just done the best it's ever done, as opposed to saying, isn't this great? Let's take it easy, let's relax, which is what comes from that thought process. I should be better. Why did I only earn $15,000 that week? I should earn $17,000 if we'd had the salads delivered a little bit better or whatever.
Right.
And so I think those three ingredients, peaking, what I call it, not losing your killer instinct.
Staying hungry. Yeah.
Staying hungry. Many people would say, I had a top 10 finish, or I got a good check, or I finished fifth, as if that's good because there are a lot of guys finishing behind me. But the champion wants to win, and he plays golf with you. He's going to give you whatever your handicap is plus a couple of strokes, and he'll play you for $1 or $100 or whatever, and he'll try to win.
It's interesting. It seems like a champion makes losing painful. They don't just accept it, and they make winning pleasurable.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right. But even having won, they want to win again and again.
And that's what keeps them going.
Yeah.
You talk about in one of your books about winning, that winning is a process, and it's one that really has to be mastered. And you also talk a little bit about how to deal with losing. Can you give us some tips in those two areas?
There are two ways of winning. One is to try to win, and the other is to refuse to lose. And they're both, Keeley always used to tell me skiing that refusing to lose was the way he used to do it. And he also had another thing on winning, which isn't responsive, but it's pretty good. He said when he tried to get ready to win the gold medals at Grenoble, that the only thought that went through his mind right as he was ready to go out of the starting gate was, he said, I have done everything I can to get ready for this. I've trained for years. I'm healthy. I certainly have the talent to do it, and I'm going to try to win. But if I don't win, my friends will still be my friends. My enemies will still be my enemies, and the world will still be the same. And that's what he thought. And that process took him through to that, and it somehow kept him looser and more at ease. I mean, people often get that looseness or being at ease from that attitude. Many people get it through a Christian faith or another faith. You've heard a lot of athletes talk about Christ and faith, and that is a way of saying, look, they're performing, and there's a bigger thing out there than this game or this match, and that's more important. And that kind of lets them be a little bit more at ease, a little bit looser in performing. It's amazing. Some people have trouble beating people they're supposed to beat and play worse against people they're supposed to beat than they do against people that they're not supposed to beat. And it's kind of like the world is expecting you to beat this person. Oh, my God, I got to do. What happens if I don't? What am I going to do? What am I doing wrong?
Asking a lot of lousy questions.
Whereas now you're playing against somebody you're supposed to lose to her, so you just wing it, and all of a sudden you play at a different level. And it's all the sports are different, and it's all these areas are very difficult. But I think the important thing on losing is to recognize that, again, being a golfer, I equate win-loss situations in business to playing golf. Nobody has played a perfect round of golf. Everyone's going to miss a couple of putts that they would like to have made or hit a ball into the rough once in a while. And I always take a loss as being one of those things. And the idea is, what's your score at the end of the day? Have I made more putts than I missed? Have I made more birdies than bogeys? And not get too worried about a loss, because, gee, I'm going to go out and I'll birdie the next hole, and not get too down about it. And I think that's another approach.
I was having dinner the other night with Ken Blanchard. He said that when he met Arnold Palmer one time, he asked him, Ken's a big golfer, and he asked him something about, I apologize, I don't know the term because I'm not a golfer, but it wasn't a chip. It's some kind of shot where you shoot the ball off in the opposite direction than you intend.
Shank.
A shank, thank you. He was saying something, how do you deal with a shank? And Palmer said to him, well, I've never hit one. And Blanchard said, well, I saw you at blank, blank course. I watched you do it a bunch of years back.
Yeah.
And Palmer said, wow, I don't remember that.
Yeah.
I thought that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, when I first learned how to ski, Keeley told me, because I didn't start till she was 20 years ago or so, and I'm not very good. I don't do it anymore. But I had my first ski lesson out in Vail, Colorado, and I fell down, and I don't know if you ski or not, but I couldn't get up. I mean, because I was on a very flat slope. And you had no hill to push yourself off of it. It wasn't that easy to get up. And I, that night I happened to talk to Keeley, and I said I had my first ski lesson today, and he said, I need your advice. I said, I couldn't get up. How do you get up when you fall down? And Keeley said, I don't know. He said, I don't fall anymore.
But is that part of success, the ability to make, quote unquote, failing painful, but then to let go of it and focus completely on the next step?
Oh, yeah.
Next focus?
I mean, you got to, again, using golf, if you've hit it in the water on one hole, to let that affect your next hole, that's the mental attitude. There are some tennis players who can hit 10 great shots in a row and hit a 11th, which is bad, and as opposed to thinking the 11th was an accident, they think, oh my God, something's going wrong with my forehand, I got to change it.
So they start to question everything.
They start questioning everything, and that of course leads into a whole avalanche effect which causes loss. I think the same thing happens in business. You all of a sudden something goes wrong, you get rattled and you lose it.
And you change your whole system, which may not be the system at all.
Yeah.
What's one of the biggest business mistakes you've ever made, and what'd you learn from it?
The biggest mistake probably was that I knew how good we were, or I was, at managing sports personalities, golfers in particular. And when I had Palmer, Player, and Nicklaus was doing a mind-blowing job for them. And I couldn't fathom the thought that any top golfer would go anywhere else but me to manage them. And I became very complacent and never went out on the tour to meet the new golfers and just sat there and figured everyone would know how good I was. And what happened was a lot of the new young golfers didn't sign with me. They signed with somebody else. And so I learned from it that no matter how good you are, you've got to continue to convince people of that on a personal basis, and you can't just be aloof from them. So that was certainly a huge mistake. We were very lucky because the people that signed the golfers were pretty incompetent, and so we were able to get back after a year or two stutter back in the early 70s. It all came back fine.
Yeah, you talk continually about patience.
Well, I learned the other one, maybe you're aiming at it, is the golf in South America, which I tend to be thinking way ahead. The older I get, the more I think way ahead, and I sometimes get way ahead of myself in my thought process, and I convinced that golf in South America was going to be a very big thing and went down there. We spent a lot of money on it, and it just didn't work for us, and we were too early. But that doesn't mean it isn't going to work, and I want to make sure when it does work, we're there again, which means that you got to keep knocking on the old doors that were once successful, and we certainly intend to do that. But timing, it can be very important with ideas, and if your timing's bad, you tend to dismiss the idea as being bad when really the idea was good and the timing was bad.
I think you're pretty famous for things where you'll come back 5 years later with something and make it happen that didn't happen previously. Is
tried
that true?
Very hard to do that, yeah.
I guess when you have 30 years of experience, you begin to notice these things. Right. Tell me, what are you most proud of that you've accomplished in your life so far? Or what are some of the things you're most proud of?
Well, there are a lot of different things in a lot of different areas. A lot of the sports events we've invented or created. I just was in London for the 28th World Match Play Golf Championship at Wentworth, which has become a huge fixture on the British and European golfing scene. And, to have conceived of it and brought it along for 28 years to where it is now is terrific. I think I conceived of and created a thing called the Sony Ranking, which is a world golf ranking, which nobody had ever even thought of doing before, and not only gotten it done, but it's now being pretty well universally accepted, and going to be in 5 more years, it'll be the only accepted criteria in golf rankings. And there have been a lot of things like that that we have done that are imaginative and fun to do. But I think really the thing I'm most proud of is to have sort of done a lot of creative things for a lot of elements of the sports in which we've touched, which have been, I think, very positive for those sports and their growth and development, and I think are pretty well recognized as such by the people that are in control of them all.
So creating something of value from...
Yeah, with doing Wimbledon products, doing the thing we've done for the Nobel Foundation, some of the things we're doing for Mayo Clinic. It's very exciting.
That's neat. I was just on a show a couple nights ago, and they had all these people, and they were talking about midlife crisis, and they brought me in and talked about midlife crisis. Mm-hmm. But the big issue that I heard people talking about again and again is that, today we have all these people in pinstripe suits that are out of work for the first time, mm-hmm. and they don't know how to deal with it. two questions, I guess, really. What would you tell somebody in that position about reinventing themselves or creating a new view for themselves? And what do you think is going to happen with our economy from your perspective as a businessman in the near future?
Well, I think the whole work ethic in America has been pretty lousy for the last 20 years, and I think the Japanese have taught us some stuff, and I think we're all recognizing that, and I think the whole them and us union management thing has cost us a lot, and hopefully we'll pull back out of it. Our business has been lucky because whereas companies, when they cut their marketing budgets, which they've all been doing, what they're doing, though, they're changing the mix in their marketing budgets, and they're doing more in sponsorship and in events than they ever did before instead of traditional media. That's helped our business. From the standpoint of the pinstripe suits people out of work, I think I've told our people, and I will continue to tell them, that the best talent in the workplace to hire today are people over 45, between 45 and 65, and even between 60 and 70, because you've got a whole thing. I'm sure you've read all of Dykewald's stuff on the age wave and all that, and you've got a lot of people that are bright and don't want to die and want to do something, and they're not trying to set the world on fire. You can hire them more economically. They're more appreciative. They're more malleable or less, you know, there's this whole era of $85,000 a year MBAs charging out and how much vacation do I get each year, kind of in the job interview. I think the opportunities for people out of work in their midlife crisis are very good, but I think what they've got to do is understand that they will get more from taking a job that gives them a lot of satisfaction and opportunity rather than worrying about the fact that they made $150,000 before they got laid off and now somebody's going to hire them for $40,000. I mean, I'd very quickly try to find the right job at 40, because if you do, you'd be back at 150 in a few years rather than getting all egotistically tripped up on, oh, well, my God, I got to have at least a senior vice president's title and I got to make this in salary and this in fringes and all that. And if they recognize that, I think more and more companies around America are going to understand that those are the kind of people that will appreciate a good job and a good workplace and a good opportunity and can be hired on a good economic basis.
Tell me about ego in business.
Well, I think it's got something that is there and something that's got to be, what do you call it, catered to rather than fought against. And I remember a story, I don't know if it was in one of my books, about this fellow invited me down to, it was a very wealthy Swiss banker and shipping magnate with a huge ego. He wanted to meet a guy I knew, and the only reason I knew him was because he was head of the Pan American Games in Venezuela. And he was in the oil business in Venezuela, and this guy wanted to meet him, and he had a huge ego. And the two guys met for dinner, and I was there. And I watched.
Was there any room?
I watched the interplay between them, and it was extraordinary. And it was one of these things where one of them would say, I gave $10 million last year to the so-and-so hospital in Tel Aviv. The other guy would say, well, I gave $15 million to the so-and-so hospital in Caracas. And it was on and on and on. And the evening ended with brandy and cigars. And so help me God.
Sounds like a movie.
Yeah. And so help me God, one of them said to the other one, do you smoke cigars? And the other guy said, yes. He said, well, have one of my cigars. I got it from President Marcos last week. And he took one and he said, well, he says, have one of mine. I just got it from Castro. And but the point is of that to me was that if, as opposed to them trying to outdo each other, and people so often, and you can spot them miles away, they want to tell you about how big their cars are, their houses are, their successes are, their businesses, their, how good a golfer they are, how pretty their wives are, all that stuff. And as opposed to trying to outdo them or get mad at them for that, that kind of person wants to have his ego played up to. And in a business sense, that's what you got to do. On a personal sense, I find it very repugnant, most of that stuff.
Interesting. Tell me, where do you see yourself 5, 10 years from now?
Here in Orlando. My goal was when I, Betsy and I built this house about 2 years ago over at Isleworth, about 5 miles away, and my goal was to have spent 100 days there in the first year and to increase it each year, just a little. And I spent 95 the first year and 92 the second, so that wasn't very good. I'm now in my third year. So I hope to spend a little bit more time here. I find it easy to get people to come here to see me. I mean, my own people love coming here for meetings, and I'll do more of that. So I'm hoping to get a little bit more relaxation time, but to continue to do what I'm doing.
And how do you describe what you do? I mean, we've heard so many of the terms from other people. Who are you?
Well, I suppose that I own and manage a international group of companies which are involved in the predominantly in the sports business, in management of sports personalities, in the running and managing of sporting events, in sports television production and sports television rights sales, and also in the classical music business. I think we're probably number two in the world now and heading for number one in the representation of classical artists and the production of classical events, concerts, and what have you. And I suppose beyond that, I've written some books which have been pretty successful, and I'm a lawyer.
Well, we won't hold that against you.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. What's a challenge still for you? What's left out there?
Well,
for you?
I'm like the guy that's not patting himself on the back. I mean, we've been doing a lot of winning in a lot of areas, but I like to make the margins of victory more, and I like to get more wins. And, you know, when I go to the Masters Golf Tournament, I want to see a leaderboard with nothing but our clients on it, as opposed to just half of our clients on it, kind of thing.
In the French Open
Tennis Championships this year, we had the two women's finalists, the two men's finalists, the two junior boys finalists, the two men's doubles teams finalists. And that was getting towards what I wanted to have, but I haven't quite conquered that yet.
What don't you have? I see this brick over here. It says, to the man who has everything.
Well, that brick was given to me by Andrea Yeager. It was supposedly a gold brick, but it was a brick painted gold.
She gave it to me wish it was a gold brick.
She gave it to me for my birthday some years ago. But no, I've been very lucky. I got a wonderful three children and a great wife, and so far got good health and all that stuff. So,
is there anything you don't have in your life?
Nothing that really hits me in the face. I suppose... you know, you want everything to be better. You want all your relationships to be better and your business to be better. But on balance, I'm about 99, I think.
That's nice. That's nice. How do you want to be remembered, Mark?
I think to be thought of somebody that as somebody that really was a pioneer in an industry, even though the industry was a speck of sand on the beach of the world, but in an industry, and that someone that's really showed a lot of new ways in a lot of new areas. I should tell you this. The Sunday Times in London just started a 26-piece series. They're doing two letters each week, A, B, C, D, E, F. And the last week they did L and M on the 1,000 people who have most impacted the 20th century. And I was one of them. And,
wow, congratulations.
And that was, I'm there with Douglas MacArthur and Marconi and Joe McCarthy and General Montgomery and a lot of those people. But anyway, I was really flattered by that. Not that it's any big deal, but it's...
It's nice.
It is nice.
Well, it is exactly to the moment of our time, so I'm going to end it with you now. And I really want to thank you.
Well, terrific.
You're such a great example, and you offer so many strategies, and hours, not enough time.
I'd like sometime to have dinner or something like that and just talk about things.
It'd be
fun. So if Mark Ryder is in touch with where you... I know you travel all the time,
yes.
And maybe we'll... find ourselves in the same community at the same time somewhere.
I'd love to meet your wife, Betsy. That'd be great.
Yeah,
and
she's...
I have my wife meet you as well.
Great.
She'd be fascinated by
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they're... in fact, what time do you go to your seminar?
Actually, I'm going to a prison. I've been asked to come by and visit. I have a whole foundation, and what we do is we get people to go out and spend a year to 2 years visiting a prisoner each month.
Well, I want... we got a prison discussion we're going to have.
Oh,
and
great.
My
fantastic.
Wife may be over right at across the street here about to have lunch. So maybe I'd like to come over and say hello for a second. Yeah.
So I just want to thank you again. And an hour and a half is not enough time for us to really get it all out. So I hope people will go pick up your books and especially stay in touch with your newsletter because that shows all your cutting edge techniques. So all of those listening, please look for the order form for Success Secrets and I highly encourage you to get involved with it. But I'll look forward to hopefully developing friendship with you and getting to know you
very
and
good.
Watch your continued growth throughout the years and hopefully see if there's any way that I can support you in any way whatsoever. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.